folks. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and this is another one of those conversation episodes where a storyteller tells me a story, and we talk about it off the cuff. This week, I had fun with the delightful Stuart Jacobson, who you can find on Instagram at Stuart Jacobson. So here I am with Stuart with a story we call Let Them Nosh Cake.
I was living in Salt Lake City. I was in my late 20s. The reason I was living there was because my wife was a doctor doing a residency there.
Mm.
And I had come from a family that was intimately connected with cake and baking. My uncle was a bakery equipment, had a bakery equipment company. And I spent a lot of the time at the back of bakeries in New York City, you know, the ethnic bakeries, the Jewish, the Hungarian, the Italian, the Greek, the German, the Austrian.
Oh, wow.
And I thought everybody ate like that, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So when I went away to graduate school, I realized that I was wrong, and I taught myself how to bake. And my wife gets into medical school and then gets a residency in Salt Lake City, and I decided I'm going to open up a bakery there.
What was it like to move from New York to Salt Lake City? That must have been a little bit of a culture shock, right?
Oh, this is 40 years ago. This is more than just a little bit of a culture shock. This was going back to the Dark Ages and then further back to the Dark Ages, so to speak. You know, it was, I didn't know any better. You know, it was definitely culture shock, and it was what it is. I didn't have a choice, you know. I was very happy to go there with her. I loved my wife. She was going to be, you know, a neurosurgeon. She was going to make a lot of money, and I just wanted to support her. And I love to ski. I love the mountains. I love camping. I love the outdoors. So it made a lot of sense. So anyway, we move out there. Not that I have backing from my family, but I have access, let's say, to build a bakery at a wholesale price as opposed to a retail price.
Uh-huh.
I found a couple of anesthesiologists who are probably the most speculative of all the medical specialties to back me in the bakery. And we opened up in an affluent neighborhood on the east side of town. We used only the best ingredients. We used only butter, no margarine, no shortening, you know. We put a cappuccino machine in. We were going to be a bakery cafe. We were going to do just top-notch stuff. And we did top-notch stuff. And we did very, very well. We gave people a good product, and we charged a high price.
Uh-huh.
So one day, a woman comes in, and I'm usually pretty good at detecting where somebody is from. This woman had this amorphous, which is probably not a good word, but undetermined foreign accent.
Uh-huh.
And she was elegantly dressed. She was probably in her late 30s, early 40s, not a single hair out of place, perfectly coiffed, perfectly made up. And she wants to order a cake, a special cake. And we have made a cake called the Mocha Bourbon Cake.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me digress and talk a little bit about what that was. It was a layer cake. And it had the French called the Genoise. It was a sponge cake, which being a sponge cake, it absorbs flavors. We'd bake the sponge cake. We'd cut it into thirds. We'd made a bourbon syrup. We took bourbon, we boiled it with sugar water, and we applied it to the cake, to the layers of the cake with a pastry brush. And we filled it with a cocoa whipped cream, and we iced it with a coffee buttercream icing.
Uh-huh.
It was a wonderful cake, not too sweet. No flavor was predominant, and we called it a Mocha Bourbon Cake. And we wrote on the cake in chocolate icing, Mocha Bourbon. Because we were living in Utah, and most of my customers were members of the Church of Latter-day Saints,
right,
being Mormons, and alcohol is taboo.
Right, right, right.
Okay, forbidden. So we wanted to let them know it was a Mocha Bourbon Cake. So this woman comes in, likes the look of the cake, orders an extra large one, you know, which we had to make special for her. We charged her a lot, okay? I mean, we charged the same as we would have charged anybody else for the cake. But it was an expensive cake. And she comes in the next day, gets the cake, and is very happy, pays us. And then the next day, at lunchtime, when my place is full of customers, she comes back in with a white guy with her, the best way to describe him. And she has the box of the cake, and it's like a third of it is gone. And she starts screaming at me in her accent, telling me that I stole her money, that I was a thief and I stole her money in front of customers, okay?
Mm.
Now, I have to tell you, here I committed a mistake, okay, right here, is that in retail, it is a sin to argue with customers.
Right.
Okay? You never argue with a customer. It just pushed my buttons. So I started to argue with her to try to convince her that, no, I'm not a thief. I didn't steal your money. You paid good money. You got a good cake. There's a misunderstanding. Here, take a cheesecake and get the hell out of here, basically.
Well, now, hold on. What was the misunderstanding?
The misunderstanding is she didn't know what bourbon was. And at the same time, her sidekick, this nebbishy white guy, non-entity, explains to me that she bought the cake to serve as a reception for her local Mormon bishop.
Oh.
And she did not know what bourbon was. And the bishop knew what bourbon was. So she was humiliated by her ignorance.
Yeah.
And she decided she was going to take it out of me.
Yeah.
And she thought that bourbon had something to do with the French royal family.
Sure, sure.
So I said, no, bourbon has to do with Kentucky, you know. We're not in Versailles, you know. You know, it's not like we're not Marie Antoinette, you know. You know, this is a retail business in the street, you know.
Yeah.
And she was... Finally got out, you know, I had to give her two cheesecakes. Finally got out of the store. She looks back at me with this look of venom and anger that if she had a gun, she would have shot me. I'm absolutely certain of that. So, you know, we go on with the day, and the next day we get a surprise visit from the health inspector.
Oh, shit.
And we were clean. Everything was cool. We were totally clean. And, you know, that was that. So a couple of days later, I get a call from the... a fellow who works for the State Alcohol and Beverage Commission.
Are you kidding?
I am not kidding.
Jesus Christ.
It gets even better. Telling me that there was a complaint. They sent in an agent to buy the cake. They tested the cake for the presence of alcohol, and they declared the cake to be, quote unquote, a mixed drink.
Wow. Okay. Jesus.
So I explained to him where I thought we had gone wrong and that we might not have boiled all the alcohol out of the bourbon. And then I said to him, oh, by the way, you know, I can go to the supermarket, the other end of the shopping center, and buy vanilla extract and add the same amount of alcohol as bourbon does.
Mm.
He said to me, yes, Mr. Jacobson, it's true, but bourbon is a beverage. Vanilla extract is not a beverage.
Mm.
So now I realize I'm up against a bureaucracy,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm not going to get anywhere with this guy. So I said, okay, you know what? I accept this warning from you. Thank you for taking the time to warn me. We're going to do a more thorough job of boiling the alcohol out of the bourbon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay? And he said to me, thank you, Mr. Jacobson. We're going to issue a formal citation, and we're going to declare it resolved. Now, again, I thought it was over at this point. But what happened was that somehow or other, the Salt Lake Tribune found out about this. I don't know how they found out about
this. Jesus Christ.
And they ran an article on it, and with my picture in it, the whole big thing about the cake. And then, again, this is the 80s, okay? The local NBC affiliates.
Oh, my God.
Picked it up and did a live cam from the store. Okay, and then the local news stations did a feature on it at night. You know, again, bringing cameras in, so showing the cake. You know, interviewing customers.
Oh my God!
And business boomed.
Oh,
just absolutely. People call me up. They wanted to come to the back door, see if they get the original cake. People call me from all over the country.
Wow!
You know, and the other thing that happened was that I would be walking down the street. At this point, I was a recognizable person.
Wow!
And Mormons would come up to me and shake my hand, hug me. They say, listen, you know, I might not want to have your cake, but I'm embarrassed by the provincialness and the bigotry of my brethren, okay?
Oh, interesting.
So we had business booming. We had people come up to me in the street. I made national news. So this woman who wanted to put me out of business, she wound up getting me fame, fortune, and friends. That's the basic story, you know, beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stick around for more of my chat with Stuart Jacobson. Now, let's get back to Stuart Jacobson, some more of his story. It's so funny that I mentioned culture shock because that is so much what that story is about. When Risk has gone to Salt Lake City before, we've run into problems. For example, we had to have one of our storytellers who was not yet 21 years old. She was on the verge of turning 21. But because the theater that we had sold alcohol, she was not allowed to enter the room. And I forget how it came to my attention, but But the venue was like, no, no, no. We don't care that she is part of the cast of the show you're putting on tonight. And we had like 300 or so people there to see the show. So she had to tell her story with a microphone that we ran. We ran the cord all the way out to the door exiting that building. And she was just this little figure in the doorway that people had to turn in their seats to see because, you know, they're that upset about the idea of someone under the age of 21 being in a room where alcohol is sold. So yeah, that is hilarious. That
Kevin, that's a great metaphor of the marginalization of people out there.
Yeah.
Really. And shunting them to the side, you know?
Yeah.
So one thing to be in the room and not have a drink or not even, you know, not be served a drink. Another thing, they have to exile her.
Yeah.
And, you know, getting more to the culture shock, you know, I have to say that I had basically really positive relationships with members of the LDS Church. I still have Mormon friends, but there's a lot of insularity there, you know, and I guess that was the culture shock. Mormons refer to non-Mormons as Gentiles. I don't know if you knew that.
That's interesting.
Pretty obvious that I'm from a Jewish family, you know, and to be known as a Gentile, you know, that was... I don't know. I wouldn't say it was refreshing, but it was certainly
a
new phenomenon. That's culture shock.
You know? Yeah, for sure.
And then I'll give you another example of culture shock out there. One of the things we did every year at Christmas is we would do all these Christmas pastries and cakes and cookies. You know, we had an English fruit cake. We had a French Bouche de Noël. We had it. We do German Pfeffernuss. we had Greek Corbiate, you know, the sugar cookies. And one point, a woman calls me up and says to me, you know, what are you doing for Christmas? I mean, it wasn't a date or anything like that, but, you know, what are you making at the bakery for Christmas? So I told her, you know, the shortcake, the Bouche de Noël, you know, and it goes through all these ethnic iterations. And she says to me, well, what's your background? So I said, you know, I'm from a Jewish family. She says, why aren't you offering any Jewish Christmas cookies? And so I said, you know, we're working on it. You know, again, I'm not going to argue with anybody.
Right. That's in the works.
Yeah. But that, again, that reinforced that cultural difference. But, you know, I love the place, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's that, too. I mean, you know, it's interesting because Salt Lake City also has, like, a very, very vibrant LGBT community.
Yes.
So it is really funny, like, where there's that cultures living together there. And it's also so spacious. That's one of the things I remember is that, like, a lot of the avenues are just, like, gargantuanly wide. It just feels like wide open country. And I think that that makes it feel, you know, like in New York, it's interesting because I love living in the neighborhoods that I like. Right now, I live in Bed-Stuy, New York. And the way that people of different income brackets, different races, different religions are all literally kind of living on top of one another. And we have these block parties that are so fun and diverse and all that sort of thing. So it's interesting that New York makes it work where everyone's kind of jam-packed together. And here I am finding myself saying, well, you know, maybe there's something also that about having a little bit of breathing room that makes it so that some of these like super, super conservative churchy folk are able to live with these super big gay communities.
Well, you know, you create your own space, you create your own comfort zone, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and I love New York. I'm from New York, so I love New York.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah. You were when we first started talking about this story, you mentioned maybe one other incident of
culture shock.
Yeah.
Right. This is on me. Okay. Oh, this is on my mother. Okay.
Oh,
Okay. This is, I went to PS-154 in Queens in, you know, Kew Gardens Hills area. And at that point, the school was predominantly Jewish. And I grew up in a very, very reform home. You know, we had bacon, you know, we had shrimp, we had lobster, a very, very, I would say unreligious, you know, we didn't observe anything basically. And I was in fifth grade and I was having lunch, you know, kids will share their lunch with each other, you know, that type of thing. And I was sharing it with this guy named Barry Mildener. That was his name. Barry Mildenberg came from a more religiously observant family than I did. And my mother that day had made me a salami sandwich using kosher salami, but she moistened the bread as opposed to, let's say, using mustard or mayonnaise with cream cheese.
Oh, uh-huh.
Which is actually not a bad combination, you know?
Sure.
Because the unctuousness and richness of the cream cheese sort of cuts the saltiness and the garlickiness of the salami. I mean, mm-hmm. My mother was a good cook. So I share half my sandwich with Barry. Barry sees what it is and has this primal atavistic freak out that came from generations ago, basically, you know?
Mm.
And I could have committed murder and he wouldn't have been any worse than his response. Uh-huh. He was absolutely appalled and freaked out. I didn't know what was wrong, you know? I didn't have a clue. And he was too upset even to be able to verbalize in a coherent manner. So I get home that day and explain to my mother what happened. And she says to me, "Oh, I guess Dad and I didn't tell you about this, that you're not supposed to mix milk and meat in the same dish."
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, you can't have a French cream sauce with you know, steak. You can't have a cheeseburger.
Uh-huh.
You know, I didn't know any of these things. You know, you can't put some cheese on your taco, you know. So what I learned from that is, you know, be careful who you share your lunch with, you know, basically. Yeah. You know, I mean, basically what I did was I good-natured and unconsciously intruded on somebody else's sensitivity, which I wound up repeating 15 years later. You know, so.
Yeah, well, it's so hard to know. I mean, kids, it's very understandable with kids because, you know, so many of those rules and customs of any religion, a lot of them are rather arcane. They have purposes that were served 2,000 years ago or whatever it is. And I remember when I was 5 years old or six or, you know, like not quite yet around the age of going to kindergarten, when the kid next door made some joke about fried chicken and watermelon and then explained to me, he whispered, he was like, that's a joke because black people like watermelon and fried chicken. And I remember just being dumbfounded, standing there thinking, who doesn't?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Yeah. I'll take that anytime, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. So kids are the best with those kinds of things because they're just like, what? Like they get to the real heart and soul of things. Like everyone fucking loves fried chicken and watermelon.
You know, I'm sure if Barry Mildner was willing to take a bite of that sandwich, he would have liked it too, you know?
Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Yeah. I live next to a Hasidic neighborhood and I went into a sushi place that was, you know, these Hasids running this sushi place. And I don't know what was going on with some of that sushi. I don't know. I don't know what some of the ingredients in there was, but it did not come from Japan. I think they were making some creative choices for the religion.
I think it's best that you still don't want to know, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's funny. Now, so how long has it been since you've done baking?
Oh, I, as a matter of fact, I've got something going right now.
Yeah, I thought you know,
I mean, professionally baking or home baking?
Yeah, well, it sounds like there's some home baking happening over there right now.
Yeah, I've got dough rising right now, you know?
Oh, that's amazing.
But I left the business when my wife finished her residency and we moved out to California. I left the business. You have to live that business, Kevin.
Oh, yeah.
I guess I didn't have the commitment to be there 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
Basically.
That was the whole time to make the donuts thing that Dunkin' Donuts had as an ad campaign for a while. That whole, you know, having to get up really early and all that. Yeah.
And in those days, the caliber of people who worked for me, let's put it like this. There was a lot of alcoholism and cocaine going on. And I got to the point where I didn't want to answer the phone at 3 a.m. because it would have meant somebody, you know, was either in jail or, you know, wasn't going to be coming in.
Yeah.
And I guess I didn't have that kind of commitment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know? That is also like, I worked at a restaurant when I was, Oh, gosh, I might have been only like 17 or 18 years old. I was still living in Cincinnati at the time. And yeah, that was my first exposure to the fact that a lot of people who work in restaurants and whatnot, they have a lot of fun with with extra chemical help.
I've got nothing against that, except I just think it should be separated from work, you know?
Yeah. For sure, for sure. That can get really messy.
Yeah, you have to demonstrate professionalism.
Well, I love it. I love that, you know, you came to storytelling only like 11 or so years ago because you were telling stories literally around a fire and people were so into it that you were like, hey, I've got something here. That's just such a, as far as a storytelling origin story goes, that's so great.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. Well, now I feel like having myself a bourbon cake, even though, you know, I'm not drinking these days. I feel like I can make, you know, just one little cheat there.
You know what? The next time you come out to California, let me know. You come over, I'll make you the cake. I'll do a good job boiling the alcohol out. I'll make the cake for you
that
guys.
That sounds fabulous.
I'm serious.
Yeah. No, I love it.
Yeah.
That sounds awesome.
It'd be my pleasure to do it, you know?
That's fabulous.
Yeah.
And that's that. You can find Stuart Jacobson on Instagram at Stuart Jacobson. And you can always reach me at kevin@risk-show.com. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk.